Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the makeup of the Syrian armed opposition, of which the al-Qaeda-affiliated al-Nusra Front comprises a small fraction. Richard Barrett, a senior director for special projects at the Qatar International Academy of Security Studies, who established the United Nations Counterterrorism Implementation Task Force, joins us to outline the composition of the ideologically diverse armed opposition in Syria. Then we'll hear from Syrian-born Rada El-Hatrash, who is a translator and columnist for Gulf News in the United Arab Emirates, who has been following the cultural revolution in Syria that has accompanied the revolution against the Assads, who have suppressed free expression in Syria for decades through fear and censorship. We will discuss the poems and writings she has translated that have flourished in social media while violence and pain from the agonizing civil war has intensified as her beloved country is torn apart. Then finally, we will speak with a former presidential speechwriter and a former special assistant to the president for public liaison to get an analysis of the heavy lift the president has with his speech to a skeptical nation about his plans for a military strike against Syria. Paul Glastris, the editor-in-chief of The Washington Monthly, and Mike Lux, the co-founder and CEO of Progressive Strategies, join us to discuss what the president can do to change the minds of the majority of Americans and members of Congress while simultaneously addressing his war plans and the Russian peace offer. Joining us now is Richard Barrett, who is a director of the Sufan Group, a New York-based security consultancy company. He's also senior director for special projects at the Qatar International Academy for Security Studies in Doha and sits on the boards of the International Center for Counterterrorism in The Hague and the Center for Global Counterterrorism Cooperation in Washington. From March 2004 to December 2012, he was the coordinator at the al-Qaeda and Taliban monitoring team at the United Nations in New York, appointed by the UN Secretary General. And in 2005, Richard helped establish a system-wide United Nations Working Group on Terrorism, which became the United Nations Counterterrorism Implementation Task Force. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Barrett.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And clearly the Assad regime, their mantra to both their own people and their supporters around the world is that it's either us, the Assad regime, or the terrorists. And on both the political left and the political right here in the United States, those opposed to President Obama's war resolution, which may or may not be voted up or down, they often reiterate the idea that at the end of the day, we're supporting terrorists like the al-Nusra Front. So it's very useful to get, since you've been working on studying the actual makeup of the armed Syrian opposition, let's begin with that basic question. Where do we stand in terms of those that are al-Nusra and al-Qaeda affiliated and the rest of the armed opposition?
Well, as you can imagine, in a place like Syria, the picture is very much more complicated than presented by Bashar al-Assad or even many domestic commentators here in the United States. I mean, essentially, there are various constituencies in Syria that are opposed to the regime. Some of them are sectarian, and some of them are secular, some of them are Kurdish, some of them are Arab, some of them are Sunni, some of them are Shiite. Some of them are supported by Turkey, others by Qatar, others by Saudi Arabia, or even by the United States. And it's a great muddle and mix of people who are taking whatever opportunity they can to get money and arms and recruits, too, to be able to fight the regime. And although I think it's commonly understood that the al-Nusra Front and now the Islamic State of Iraq and Levant, which is also an al-Qaeda group, which is more better known, I would have thought, in Iraq as the Islamic State of Iraq, it's well known that those two groups are much more effective on the battlefield than many of the Free Syrian Army elements or the other sort of disassociated, unassociated groups that exist there. But even so, just because they're effective, it doesn't mean to say that they're necessarily driven by the al-Qaeda ideology. And I think it's important to consider what sort of people are joining the al-Qaeda groups there. Certainly the leadership does, I think, follow an al-Qaeda philosophy and ideology. But I think many of the members may be going there because they can get armed, because they can feel that they're on the front line, that they're doing something useful. And you know, they may achieve a result. But whether that denotes any particular affinity to al-Qaeda or not is another matter. And I think when the battle's all over, whenever that may be, we won't necessarily see great groups of al-Qaeda people wandering the country and trying to take it over.
But in terms of the analysis that you've done for the Sufan group, it says that the Free Syrian Army's membership is between 10,000 and 50,000 fighters. The next biggest group is the Syrian Liberation Front that has an estimated 37,000 fighters. That's supported by Saudi Arabia, but it's not an Islamic group per se. Then you've got this Syrian Islamic Front, which has about 13,000 fighters. And then you've got the al-Nusra, and it's the other ISIS, Iraq front, with 6,000 fighters. So if you combine the totals of the first three, which are not al-Qaeda affiliated, then al-Nusra is a very small force by comparison.
Well, absolutely. And I think there's another point there, too. I mean, I think this figure of combining the Syrian Liberation Front and the Syrian Islamic Front together, you know, is a fair indication of the number of rebels, but there'll be many more who aren't affiliated to either of those groups. So that, let's say, 100,000 or so may bump up to almost 150,000. But in the Jabhat al-Nusra, you've got 6,000 people. Maybe, you know, 600 or 800 of them are foreigners, too. There'll be quite a lot of foreigners, though most of them will probably be Syrian. But our analysis suggests that many people are joining those al-Nusra leaders, you know, and they're all broken up into little cells, too. I'm not sure how unified a command they have, because that's an effective way of challenging the regime, and not because they think al-Qaeda is the answer for, you know, Muslims all over the world, and they're looking for sort of the establishment of some sort of caliphate and, you know, commit terrorist acts wherever they may be.
So what is the attitude, since you work in Qatar, what is the attitude of the Qatari government? That I understood they support the Muslim Brotherhood. The Saudis are accused of being the main supporter of the jihadists and the al-Qaeda-affiliated people. Is that official Saudi policy or is that private money?
No, I think it's private money. I don't think any official body supports al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is really an enemy of everybody, whether Qataris, Saudis, or anybody else. And so nobody would want their money and arms to be going to al-Qaeda. Of course, once stuff is in Syria, whether they're arms or other provisions, then it's a tradable commodity, and people will sell stuff on, or they'll give stuff on, or they may lose stuff, or whatever. So there's not very much control of the material once it goes in. And I think this is the principal reason behind United States' reluctance to provide significant weapons to the rebels, because of that uncertainty of who might be the end user.
So when many people tell me, and following you on the program today, there's a Syrian woman who's in touch with a lot of poets and writers in Syria and in the refugee camps. And the refrain that one always hears is that if only the West had supported the Free Syrian Army early on, before these other elements infiltrated, the jihadi elements and the Salafists, we wouldn't have the problem we have today. Do you buy that?
Well, I'd say to that two things. First of all, well, we are where we are, and we better get on with it, you know, and try and sort it out. And second, the Free Syrian Army has been a complete shambles from the very start, both politically and militarily. And so I don't think it would have made any difference. And the only thing that might have happened is if some sort of strong core of Syrian rebels had been properly trained and equipped, so that around them could coalesce all these people who've come in to join the fight or who want to join the fight, you know, from other areas of the country. But I don't see that that could have happened very quickly. And when all this stuff started in March 2011, it was a peaceful protest. It wasn't an armed revolution, and I don't think anybody anywhere else wanted it to be an armed revolution. They hoped that, similar perhaps to what happened in Tunisia, that the government would fall relatively quickly, and then the Syrians themselves would be able to sort out a new government, a new administration, without fighting each other too much. Well, that opportunity, of course, has passed. And one of the things that has happened now, I think, is that the battle has got more and more sectarian in nature, and that makes it very, very hard indeed for anybody to take over in the future, because Sunnis won't trust Shia, and the Shia won't trust Sunnis, and so on, and they'll all want to control their own areas where they're dominant. And so I think that to say that if we'd intervened earlier, it would have made everything absolutely beautiful and wonderful and all be over and done and dusted by now is misleading.
Again, I'm speaking with Richard Barrett, who's the director of the Sufan Group, a New York-based security consultancy company. He's also senior director for special projects at the Qatar International Academy for Security Policy in Doha and sits on the board of the International Center for Counterterrorism in The Hague and the Center for Global Counterterrorism Cooperation in Washington. He was the coordinator at the Al-Qaeda and Taliban monitoring team at the United Nations in New York, appointed by the UN Secretary General. And in 2005, Richard helped establish a system-wide United Nations Working Group on Terrorism, which became the United Nations Counterterrorism Implementation Task Force. Now, assuming that the Russian plan is not adopted, or, you know, there's obviously a lot of tension at the UN over whether it's a stalling tactic or not, but if a strike goes ahead, if as some suggest that it should be what they call regime decapitation, even though it's never been stated by the President or the Secretary of State, would that scenario, and I talk to people in the Syrian opposition who say that if Assad goes, all our problems go away. Is that a realistic proposal? Not so much the regime decapitation part of it, but the idea that seems to be prevalent that if Assad goes, suddenly the country can heal itself. Do you believe that?
Well, I'm afraid I don't. I think it's wishful thinking. Sure, Assad may be supported by a pretty small group of people who hold power in the country or in the country that's under government control. But to remove him or even all of them, I don't think is going to solve all the problems of Syria. You have had now an extraordinarily bitter civil war, and to heal the wounds of a civil war takes a long time. You know, there are 6 million Syrians displaced in one way or another, 2 million of them being out of the country. And to sort all that out is going to be an enormous problem, which is going to involve the international community, of course, as well as the Syrians themselves. And so saying that, oh, well, just get rid of Assad and maybe one or two of his cronies and we'll be able to move forward, I think it's completely unrealistic. And I think that Syrians and other commentators need to get real on this. They need to understand the very long-term problems that are now faced in Syria, and not just by the sort of dissolution of the borders and the regional fragility that flows from that, but by the geopolitics, which has become involved too, with Russia looking to maintain some influence in the Middle East, with Syria being a battleground for Iran's influence as well, and trying to maintain its links with Hezbollah and its ability to provision Hezbollah through Syria and so on. You know, Turkey's position now is very awkward, and the Kurdish resurgence in Iraq and in Turkey. You know, all these things are going to take a very long time to sort out. And I think for most people, there's probably some sort of comfort in just seeing the thing bubble along, obviously not with chemical weapons being used and stuff like that, but to bubble along while people come forward with some sort of more practical solution than just, you know, decapitating the regime.
But you would think that there'd be common interest between the United States and Russia not to have Syria end up as a Somalia on the Mediterranean, and particularly with Russia's fear of the jihadis, which the U.S., after all, has this so-called war on terror against al-Qaeda, so they can't possibly want to see al-Qaeda take over. So where's the common ground?
Well, I think there is a common ground. Yeah, sure, you're right, obviously, that they don't want to see a Somalia in the Mediterranean. But even Somalia is sort of more or less contained within Somalia for the moment, though one could very easily imagine it spilling over into Kenya. And Syria is more or less contained in Syria at the moment, although one could very easily imagine it spilling over into Lebanon and Jordan and possibly other countries in the region. So there must be a common agreement between Russia and the United States that there's a need for stability, and there's a need for stability which doesn't empower al-Qaeda, so there's some regime in Damascus which is strong enough to deal with the al-Qaeda threat. But I don't know how you would express that in terms of what to do tomorrow. You know, I think over the long term, yes, you know, there should be some sort of way of working through this shared problem. So far as tomorrow is concerned, I think it's much more of a contest between Russia and the United States in terms of influence in the area. I mean, if you take Syria away, Russia hasn't really got any friends in that particular area, and I think that's a problem that they're very aware of. But if you leave Syria in turmoil, then it makes the United States' position extremely uncomfortable in the area, and of course can empower Iran. So it's a period of transition, in my view, where common interests may be outweighed by competitive interests.
But surely the Russians don't want to be humiliated on the world stage by not being able to do anything about an American strike against their number one and only ally and only base in the Mediterranean. So unless the Russians, you know, are they coming to the table because they don't want to be humiliated, or are they coming to the table with this proposal that Kerry sort of seemed to have accidentally mentioned? Mm-hmm. Are they coming to the table because they believe that the American strike will work and that they want to keep their foot in the door?
Well, I'm not sure what they think the American strike would do. I mean, the United States has made clear that it's not after regime change. It's after punishing and trying to prevent the further use of chemical weapons. So if that's what's going to happen, then, you know, so far as the Russians are concerned, their client Assad is concerned, not much will change. Maybe the regime will be weaker, but maybe the limits of American power and ability to make a big difference on the ground by a strike will in some way strengthen the regime. So I think the Russians are a little bit ambivalent about that. But I think they will, if the Americans do go ahead with the strike, I think the Russians will be able to say to the international community, you know, what was all this about? What was the legal basis for this? You know, they'll be raising it at the Security Council. And as we know, the majority opinion in many Western countries is opposed to a strike. So there may be some sort of resonance for Russia in that, which they'll milk for what it's worth, I guess. But I think that the other issue is that the proposal that's apparently been made in the margins of the G20 summit and repeated by Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign ministry, that somehow the Syrians will hand over their chemical weapons to international control, they'll sign up to the international prohibition on the use of chemical weapons and so on, and, you know, that will sort of draw a line under this and do effectively what the Americans are saying they want to achieve. It's a very clever proposal, and in fact, it's quite a good proposal. I don't see that it's all bad by any means, you know, as an international initiative, not just as something to serve Russian interests.
Well, indeed, and it could resonate with the Iranians. It would set a precedent, wouldn't it?
Well, indeed, yeah. You know, I mean, if it could be taken through, the downside, of course, is that it's signed by Bashar al-Assad and his government, and people are wanting that government to fall. So, you know, it's sort of legitimizing the government. But on the upside, yeah, sure, here's a country which has consistently, for years and years and years, denied possessing any chemical weapons, now saying, yes, we do have them. Yes, we'll put them under international control and move towards getting rid of them, and we will sign up to the international agreement. So when you look at Iran and nuclear capabilities and so on, Iran may feel, okay, well, you know, there's an opportunity here to move forward to some sort of international agreement on our side as well.
Well, just in closing, Richard Barrett, if the Assad regime eventually falls, how could the radical elements like al-Nusra be marginalized? Who would do that? You'd need boots on the ground. You'd need somebody to disarm these people, wouldn't you?
Well, it would be up to the Syrians themselves. And there are two things there. First of all, I don't think the Syrians have any patience with the al-Qaeda ideas, you know, if you're talking about all Syrians. I think very, very few indeed would sympathize with al-Qaeda. Secondly, they can look over the border at Iraq and see what a complete mess mayhem has been created by al-Qaeda there, and they certainly don't want to import that into Syria either. And I think third, many of the Syrians who have sort of fighting with al-Qaeda at the moment will leave al-Qaeda once the objective's been achieved of overthrowing Assad. So al-Qaeda, I hope, would be isolated, would be on the back foot, and would be extremely unpopular in Syria and be forced back over the border into Iraq.
So just in closing, though, the point I'm getting from you is that the whole al-Qaeda element is being exaggerated.
It's there. We can't deny it's there. And it's difficult to assess its strength. And certainly there are many people there, and also from many other nationalities, who are fighting. And by fighting, they're getting trained, they're getting better at it, and maybe they're getting radicalized too. But just because people are going there to fight Bashar al-Assad and his regime doesn't necessarily mean they're all al-Qaeda terrorists. You know, there are two different motivations there. So although you've got an al-Qaeda group, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's, you know, going to start causing lots of problems by setting off bombs in Manhattan or Los Angeles. And I think the other thing that you can see happening in Syria is that the Jabhat al-Nusra, the original sort of al-Qaeda group, is already splitting up. You have a split between them and the Iraqi al-Qaeda people who've come in to join the fight, and indeed with some of the foreigners. Now, we saw the other day that there's a Caucasian, you know, group from the Caucasus who are fighting there, who say they are affiliated but independent from Jabhat al-Nusra and other al-Qaeda groups. So I think they'll be fighting among themselves as well as fighting against them by everybody else.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Richard Barrett.
A pleasure.
Again, I mean, speaking with Richard Barrett, who's the director of the Sufan Group, a New York-based security consultancy company. He's also senior director for special projects at the Qatar International Academy for Security Studies in Doha and sits on the boards of the International Center for Counterterrorism in The Hague and the Center for Global Counterterrorism Cooperation in Washington. From March 2004 to December 2012, he was the coordinator of the Al-Qaeda and Taliban monitoring group at the United Nations in New York, appointed by the UN Secretary General. And in 2005, Richard helped establish a system-wide United Nations Working Group on Terrorism, which became the United Nations Counterterrorism Implementation Task Force. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back in a moment talking about the cultural revolution in Syria, where poetry is flourishing in the midst of the pain.